Today's date is May 12th, 2017. My name is Sharon Hollinsby, and I have the pleasure today of interviewing Jason Lazarus in his office in the Bunnell Building on the University of Alaska Fairbanks campus. The rationale or the cause for the interview is that Jason, a photography teacher in the Communication and Journalism Department, will have a display of his photographs this summer in the Museum of the North, and it seemed a good opportunity to get a live interview with the artist in conjunction with the exhibit. Thank you for agreeing to do this, Jason.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
Okay, let's start with a bit of history. Mm-hmm. And where would you like to start with history for you as a photographer?
Probably way back in high school. In all honesty, I never really took much of an interest as a child with photography. It wasn't until my senior year that while I was looking at the catalog for another class to take, because I only needed a credit and a half, I ended up finding a darkroom photography class and decided to try my hand at it. My father had taken a couple classes during high school, and that piqued my interest to take it myself. And as soon as I developed my first roll of film and saw that print coming out of the developer, seeing that magic really, really just made me excited to take more classes. And within the next semester and a half, I ended up taking every single course that I could at Lathrop High School for photography.
So you were raised in Fairbanks?
I wasn't raised in Fairbanks. I was a military brat, so I ended up getting transferred here when I was 16 and decided to stay for college here. Started with a computer science degree, and after about 5 years of struggling with a bachelor's of science in computer science, I decided, you know, maybe I'm going down the wrong path. Math and I did not agree very well. On the other hand, I had been taking all of these electives in the darkroom and in the computer labs that were focused on photography, and I was doing fine in those. Realized 5 years into my undergrad here at UAF that I was a semester away from graduating, or about a year away from graduating in my fourth year, I should be a little bit more accurate. And I was only about a year away from graduating if I went with a photojournalism degree. But I would still be 3 years away from getting a undergrad degree in computer science. And so I switched my degree, ended up graduating, and eventually got a job at the Communications and Journalism Department. At that time, it was just the journalism department, and I was managing their computer labs. But over the course of the last 12 years, I've kind of put my foot in the door every opportunity that I can, from teaching the darkroom labs to teaching summer sessions, and then during the regular semester. And I keep on, I've kept on doing that for the last decade or so.
So how long have you worked for the department now?
So I've worked since 2005, so 12 years.
12 years, yep. Okay. And have you, through the years, developed a special interest in any particular form of photography or development or whatever?
Definitely. It's challenging to talk about it because I started off in the darkroom and eventually kind of fell out of love with the darkroom for mm-hmm. a couple years mm-hmm. because technology had moved past the darkroom and everyone was using a digital camera. And as a computer tech myself, as well as just a tech head in general, I really wanted to go the digital route. But I really felt that I lost something with digital because there was no tangibility in what I was creating anymore. It all lived on my hard drive, and on top of that, I never got my hands dirty. I never felt like I was really creating anything. And so because of that, I ended up getting really frustrated with the lack of movement in my work. My work seemed to stagnate right after I graduated, and I struggled for a couple of years, and eventually, after teaching for a while, I decided to pursue my MFA in photography from the Academy of Art University in San Francisco.
That involve going to San Francisco?
No. Okay. So I did everything online. It was an incredibly rigorous program. Their institution is known for really only graduating about 10% of the people that start there. So it's an incredibly challenging program, and it really opened my eyes to it. To photography in general, because one of the first classes I had to take was history of photography, and even though I had known some of the other more archaic processes out there, I was blown away with how many antiquarian processes were out there and still being practiced today. And that was what hooked me. You know, you can go into a darkroom and make a traditional darkroom print, put it in a frame, put it behind glass, put it on a wall in a gallery, and 90%, probably 95% of people won't even know that it's from the darkroom. So your audience doesn't really care that you took the extra effort to not just hit the digital print button and come out with an image. On the other hand, with working with more historical processes or alternative processes, the resulting image ends up being a tangible art element that people can interact with. You can see the texture of the paper coming through. You can see the workmanship behind the print. And so it's almost like your hands are not just involved in the print, but part of you ends up in the print.
So the hand of the artist is a visible thing anyway.
Exactly, yeah. And so that has become huge part of what I do as an artist is try to make sure that whatever I create has a piece of me in it. And so through my graduate studies, I really worked on perfecting the Van Dyke Brown process, which I used on my series of mining apparitions, where I took models out to local mines throughout Alaska and had them reenact elements of daily life at the mines. Mm-hmm. The mines ended up being a huge muse for me through that process. As soon as I graduated UAF with my undergrad, I started looking for something to photograph. And although a lot of people, especially in Alaska, look at the natural landscape or the wildlife for inspiration, I knew that there were hundreds, if not thousands, of people already doing that, and that I really wanted my work to look different than other people's. And as well, I couldn't really invest myself in that because I wasn't passionate about it.
What do you mean by that? I mean, invest in what?
I couldn't invest in that subject matter because I wasn't passionate about it. You know, anyone can take a picture of a mountain, and certainly there are people that do it with Ansel Adams quality, and they really imbue their work with that awe and amazement of seeing that for the first time. I couldn't find the passion inside me to end up doing that. And so I ended up avoiding a lot of traditional Alaskana subject matter. And the mines ended up being something that really got the creative juices to flow. I'd go out to these places, and I was always interested in abandoned places because of my time in Europe. I spent a good portion of my childhood in Europe, and got used to the idea of walking through the woods and finding a castle, a medieval battlement, or just seeing history alive all over the place there. And hundreds, if not thousands, of years of history right there, rather than a mere 100 or 200 like we have in the interior here. So finding those hidden stories in the mines ended up being a huge portion of what I wanted my earlier work to say, to focus on. I wanted to focus on kind of explaining why we needed to preserve these stories and these places, because it's a lot of Alaska's early history that's out there in the woods just rotting away. And we have a tendency in Alaska to bulldoze over our history, to forget it and to neglect it until it's not worth saving. And so one of the things that I was hoping my earlier series would do would be to inspire people to do exactly that, to start saving that history and to start respecting it. Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. Pay attention to it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's evolved kind of over the last few years. Mm-hmm. Is that where you are now, to still involved in that, or have you moved on to something else?
So I have moved on. Mm-hmm. That earlier work with mine spanned about 5, maybe 6 years of me trying to figure out how I was going to tell the stories, going to graduate school to try to work on imbuing my work with narrative, trying to figure out how to take the photographic tools that I knew how to use and then combine it with that storytelling element. Because anyone can take a photo, but how do you figure out how to define the 1,000 words that photo means?
So what kind of answer have you been coming up with?
It took a long time for me to figure out how to do that, because I'd go out to the mines and take a picture of an old coffee can out there. And I'd be so excited about the texture, about the antique quality of the subject matter, of the atmosphere, of all the dust and dirt and grime all over the place.
The feel of the place.
And I try to tell people that feel of the place actually meant the story that I wanted to tell, mm-hmm. that we needed to preserve this. And all people saw was just old junk. And so it took me a long time to figure out how to end up doing that. And
well, let me another question. How did you find out that that's what they thought?
Oh, I asked people. I had several local shows here, and I'm a firm believer in asking for harsh critique. And when I noticed that people would go through and just kind of browse the work almost as quickly as possible just to get to the food table, I realized something was wrong. So I started asking the hard questions of, you know, what do you think of the work? What does it make you think of? Oh, yeah, great old stuff.
Uh-huh.
That's
it. I want
it.
You to feel good.
Great old stuff. Yeah. It's really good. Yeah. Old stuff. Do you think we should save the mines? Does this make you want to go out there and find this history? Oh, I like old stuff, but yeah, it doesn't tell me anything about this place. I don't know where this is. Yeah. And so after getting that for a couple years, I started looking for a way to imbue the images that I was creating out there with story. And so what I started doing was playing with the idea of incorporating apparitions in the shot. So having models photographed in the scene and then digitally stitching images together to go ahead and give a sense of like a latent life force left behind, a ghost or an apparition left behind, because that was what I was always trying to convey. Since first time that I went out to one of these mines, the first thing that I felt was that there was something left behind. And not in a spooky Scooby-Doo kind of way, but that there was something very real and tangible there, or nearly tangible there. And I wanted to capture what was left behind. And so I started working with a variety of different models, bringing them out there, having them pose, and taking two negatives that I would eventually stitch those two together digitally and fade one so that it would seem like they were fading away. And so half of the fun of the work is to find the people to begin with.
So these are digital that you're talking about. When you say negatives, I wondered if you meant.
So I actually started shooting with film. I would then scan the negatives in, making them digital files, and then I would digitally composite them together. Now, I mentioned earlier that I was working with historical processes. So the Van Dyke-Baron process requires that you have a negative the same size of the resulting print that you want. So there's no enlarging. And so what you have to do is end up making, if you want an 8x10 print, you have to make an 8x10 negative.
How do you do that?
So in Photoshop, you invert your tones, you apply a specific curve or an edit to the image to make it work for the process that you're going to print it in. And then you print it in on high quality transparency film. So by inverting the image, all of the tones are inverted, just like a negative. And when you print it on something that's see-through, you end up getting a negative off of it.
So you don't then have to use a large camera with a plate, a big plate, in order to get a big negative?
No, you can. And a lot of people do that, but as it is, I carry around enough gear already into the middle of the woods. An 8x10 camera would be overkill, I think. I am shooting in a medium format camera, and at that time it was a studio medium format camera, so I was still hauling around a good 30, 40 pounds into the woods. That was just one camera. So, but you take the resulting image that you get out of your digital printer, you take that and you put it on top of paper that you've sensitized with chemicals, light sensitive chemicals.
You've done that yourself. It doesn't come that way. Okay.
No. So I make my own photo paper at home by placing Van Dyke-Baron chemicals on traditional watercolor paper, generally hot press watercolor paper, to make sure that you have good registry between the two. Your negative and your paper. You want to be able to really squish those together. And then I have these things called contact printing frames, which is how they used to make prints from negatives back in the 1860s, 1850s, where it's a pane of glass. It looks like a picture frame, but from the back, you can remove the back and put your negative and paper in, and then pressure plate that back so that it squeezes everything together.
Is this in a darkroom?
Most of these processes are not sensitive enough to where you're required to do it in the darkroom, but I do it in a dim room. So indoors.
Just the pressure itself will make the image transfer? Is that?
No. Okay. So what that does, and let me get a visual aid here. Okay. I know it won't help out with your recording, but I'll be...
Okay.
So this is a contact printing frame, and you have these pressure points in the back that allow you to squeeze everything together. Mm-hmm. So you place your negative there, you put your sensitized paper, this is photo-sensitive paper, and then you put the back on, push in the pressure plate, and keep it locked. And then you go outside with this, face the glass toward the sun, and you end up getting an exposure that way. So these exposures range from anywhere from 3 to 4 minutes to maybe 20 or 25 minutes.
Depending on what?
Depending on how much light you have and depending on what kind of light source you're using. So Obviously, in winter, we don't have too much light out here. So because of that, I end up using a UV printing box. And so I've got a bunch of black lights, basically, mm-hmm. inside of a box that I slide this into. And so because those aren't nearly as bright as the sun, you end up having a much, much longer exposure. And so light travels through the negative and exposes the paper. The darker areas of the negative expose less on the paper, and so your negative ends up reversing into a positive on the paper.
And that's your photograph?
That's my photograph. Mm-hmm. Then I have to process that through some chemical processes to make sure that it fixes, that it doesn't continue to alter and change. You want to make sure that the paper is no longer light reactive, otherwise it will continue to change.
Okay, I need to ask a question, backing up a little bit.
Uh-huh.
Where is the image? I mean, the image that you're impressing onto the paper, there's got to be an image of some sort.
So the image is on that negative, that transparency.
Okay, I'm trying to picture this and I'm missing uh-huh. things, I think. Okay, but I understand what you're saying.
I was hoping that I'd have one, but I don't have one right now.
That's okay, I think I'm catching on. Yeah,
basically it's a transparency with an inversed image on it.
Okay, mm-hmm. All right.
Yep.
So you're doing some of that still these days?
Yeah. Okay. So that's what these are here. And this is the series that I've worked on for a couple years. And so I'm placing people inside of the frame. I've got it set up to where it's almost a diptych, but almost a triptych as well. So you have an 8x10 image on top that has the apparitions inside of it. And they're doing something day-to-day.
It looks real. I mean, it looks, mm-hmm. Like it's an old picture.
Yeah, and in fact, I've had a lot of people think that they're archived images. The bottom image ends up getting another overall scene of one of the mines, but also shows an artifact. Because one of the things that I wanted to do was go out to the mine and photograph what was left behind, the little bits of history that's left behind at the mines, is I think that it's important that if we want to save these places and their artifacts, we have to imbue them with the stories of the people that made these places what they were. And so this isn't just a scrap of junk found on the floor. This is something that these men work with in this mine. And so you connect it with the place, you connect it with the people, and now that item means something. It's just like any antique. If you have a story behind it, it makes it so much more interesting.
Yeah, I really like that.
So this is the series that will be hanging in the museum. And I've worked throughout the state to photograph everywhere from Coldfoot to Juneau, mm-hmm. and feel free to just pick up the frames. And so this is down in Palmer. So this is Hatcher's Pass. I've tried to really focus on places that have not been restored or preserved. This is the only one that's kind of in that mixture of arrested decay. They haven't really fixed it up, but on the other hand, it's still there.
Now this is Fairbanks.
Yeah, so there's that connection of story as well here. You know, the fact that these men chose to live here while there were modern apartment complexes down in the cities that they could live in. So they were living in these kind of environments where everyone else in Fairbanks was living in apartment complexes.
So this is the interior that you shot in the Polaris building?
No. Okay. So this is just an advertisement for the Polaris building out at one of the mines.
Okay.
So this is up by Eagle Summit.
So I noticed the stove sitting on buckets.
Yeah, ingenuity there.
Yeah,
some bush ingenuity going on.
Yeah. it looks like it just happened. You know what I mean? All this stuff here.
Mm-hmm.
Like it just scattered all these wood chips in there.
Yeah. Some of these, that's in a pretty high alpine valley, so I'm sure that they get all kinds of avalanches in that area. This was during my residency out at McCarthy. I ended up getting some really amazing access to the Kennecott mine, kind of under the cover. This is one of my favorites. The bottom image is from that Eagle Summit mine that I was talking about up on Steese Highway. It's so far down in the valley that most people don't go there. Not to mention it's owned by John Reeves, and he's very, very firm on making sure that people have obtained permission to go onto his property. And so I did so, and went out to this mine, and the bed has a caribou hide blanket still on it, and the mirror in the dresser set is still unbroken.
Isn't that amazing? Well, this is the
This is the inside of that building. I involved my wife in a couple of these shots, having her go out in high heels in these broken down environments, and photographing.
Is that you?
Yeah.
So you had set up a tripod.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And a timer. Yep.
This is all right.
That one I love because of the newspaper clipping, having Nina goes a-hunting and gets two trophies. It's so completely opposite of what you'd see in the newspaper today.
Well, especially the way she's dressed.
Okay. Yeah. She's actually dressed up. She's done her hair.
To
go bear hunting.
It's very attractive. Right.
You gotta wonder whether or not they just post the shot afterwards.
Maybe. So these are all the works that are gonna go hanging in the exhibit,
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
Let's see. So this is up in Wiseman.
Mm-hmm. Any others in here that you particularly like?
Oh gosh. Let me run through them really quick so that I can see.
This is lovely. I like this
one's
relationship
done down in Juneau at Treadwell Mine. I had to make sure that I went out right at low tide to go ahead and get this, because this is in the middle of Gastineau Channel.
So each of these then was impressed onto treated paper,
yes,
watercolor paper.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, just the way you showed me in that.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Wow.
And so each exposure is 18 minutes long for these.
Were they all done at a certain time of the year?
So they're all done in my UV box at home, so I don't have to worry about that.
You can control things pretty
mm-hmm.
well.
Yep.
Yeah, this is very fresh looking. Very interesting. So what are these?
Okay, so these are some new bodies of work that I'm currently working on.
What's that?
Okay, let's switch these around so that we can get to these. So these are chemograms, and they're from a series called Emblem and Artifice that I've been working on. These are digital reproductions of their original images. Mm-hmm. Let me get an original out here for you to look at. So what these are, they're chemograms, so they're photographic paper. This photographic paper is over 70 years old. So it expired the week after the bombing of Hiroshima. And so for most traditional photographic processes, the paper is far too expired to mm-hmm. actually use for traditional processes. Mm-hmm. But I had went to a workshop on the chemogram process and wanted to use this old paper for something. And old paper's great
Where
for the chemogram process. Actually, I had someone in Anchorage end up donating their mother's entire darkroom to me.
So this was blank paper?
This was blank paper, yeah. Mm-hmm. So what the chemogram process is, I decided after playing around a little bit with this paper that specifically because of the date, the fact that the paper was new around the time of World War II, that it expired a week after the Hiroshima bombing, that significance really, really resonated with me, and I wanted to make it into a project somehow. And so I decided to start playing around with symbols and focusing specifically on World War II symbols. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And so you can thumb through these. These are nice and easy to thumb through.
Okay. these are really beautiful.
And so
this texture, color, all of them.
And so what I wanted to
do. So this is from the old.
Yep, those are just digital enlargements, basically. I had a show in Southern California that did not want to have the originals on display because these are one of a kind. They will never be remade.
Right.
So the digital reproductions are a good way to go.
So you, this is the only chance you have then to make this kind of photograph, is that
yeah.
right?
Yeah, so let me tell you a bit about the project. After finding out that expiration date with the paper, I wanted to design something around World War II symbolism. It's particularly, especially with the world that we're living in right now, I think that a lot of people have forgotten a lot of the history attached to that conflict. A lot of the reasons why it happened and why we allowed such atrocities to end up happening. And I think particularly what's important is that we've learned one side of history. History is always written by the victors. So what about the other side? What's the stuff that brought us to where we were? You know, what made us think that using a nuclear bomb was an acceptable method of ending the conflict? What was the arguments there? What
did you find some answers?
Yeah, actually, quite a few. I focused on looking for symbols and focusing specifically on the dual nature of many of these symbols, what they meant to the Allies, what they meant to the Axis. A symbol of hope for one side might be a symbol of terror for another side. And so because of that, I created diptychs of them to focus on the dual nature of these symbols, to focus on the fact that even though no doubt most people would never say that there's anything positive about Zyklon B and the final solution for the Jews in Europe. What brought the Germans to think that was an appropriate solution to their problems? Because those are the things that we ignore in the history books, and we see history repeating itself now, very slowly, starting to repeat itself now, because we ignore the warning signs, what brought it on. And so the whole concept behind the process, the project, is to really focus on reminding people what happened, why it happened, and maybe revealing some stories along with it, with why the other side saw this as a solution. Whether it was Zyklon B, whether it was the nuclear bomb. I ended up reading a lot of books on the subject for the last couple of years focusing on first-hand accounts or second-hand accounts of what happened. John Hershey's book on Hiroshima specifically was eye-opening and shocking. And unfortunately, I think that a lot of people my age or people my son's age don't really know too much about it. And especially now with where politics are going in our country, especially with things like the Muslim ban and focusing on altering and changing immigration, and focusing on blaming immigrants for everything, it really does have shades of what happened during World War II. The finger pointing, the focus of blame on the Jews or the Polish or any other group that the Third Reich focus on. And I think that it's really important for people to remember that. And to realize that as much as we vilify the other side, they were people too. And so what led them to that? Yeah. So the process itself with these prints, because the photo paper is 70 years expired, what I'm doing here is I'm taking traditional photographic paper and spraying a resist on top, okay? The resist, in this case, is a polyacrylic resist that I'm just painting on or spraying on. I'm allowing that to dry, and then I'm cutting in a pattern, not into the paper, but into the resist itself. Because these are diptychs, I'm taking two sheets of paper, making the same exact pattern on both sheets of paper. And then I'm going through the chemogram process oppositely, depending on what print I'm doing, whether it's the left one or the right one. So how you work with photo paper in particular is that when you have a traditional darkroom print, you go into the darkroom, expose the paper to an image, a negative, and then you place it into developer. Developer allows the latent image, the invisible image, to come up. After that point, you have to wash it and then put it into Fixer. Fixer makes the paper or renders it non-light reactive. Mm-hmm. So after that point, it's safe. So with this layer of resist on the paper, the chemicals aren't actually getting to the paper surface, except through those little cuts that I made. And so I start one in developer, which, because I've got lights on, instantly turns those lines black. I've got one in Fixer, which turns those lines white. I go back and forth between the two chemicals, and as the chemicals etch away the resist, wear out the resist, and it starts peeling off, it reveals other layers underneath, which gets exposed to a different chemical. And so you have this effect that looks very much like rust when you end up completing it. And peeling away all of the resist. The back and forth nature of going between developer and Fixer ends up making it look like gasoline pools or rust. And that pattern that looks like decay, to me at least, really, really makes me think that these are symbols that have been forgotten and neglected, and their meaning has been forgotten and neglected as well. So it works well with the project.
Yeah, it's very interesting and quite involved, and that your access to this old paper is really unique, it sounds like.
And so that's the other thing. Unlike other photographic processes where I can always put in another SD card into my digital camera, or I can always end up putting in another load of film,
With this, I had a finite material. Mm-hmm. After this box is done, there's no more.
Do you have to do anything to preserve the paper at this time?
No. Usually, so long as you wash photographic paper really well, because this is fibrous paper, it ends up flushing the chemicals out of it, and so it's preserved after that. It's archival paper.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, I think there was another method you were going to talk about, and then I got so interested in this that you switched over to that. Was there something else that you wanted to...
No, I've just got a different body of work that I can show
you. Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah, sure.
Yeah. Okay. So, I've got this new set of Alaskan landscapes that I'm focusing on. This is purely digital work. Unlike the other two series. But what I'm doing here is not focusing on beautiful Alaska. I'm focusing on the textures, on the dreary weather, the sad, somber quality of Alaskan winters.
Oh, now this looks a little like a monochrome, but then I see color.
Just
here.
Little smatterings,
yes,
of
right.
color.
Mm-hmm. Just a faint blue here. Now, these seem rather beautiful to me.
Thank you.
Maybe not to you,
thank
but
you.
Yeah, the texture is lovely.
Oh, no, no, I certainly paper. Do enjoy them. Just because I'm using terms like gloomy and sad doesn't
okay.
mean that I don't. I love these images.
Yeah.
And
this is wonderful. What is that?
That's just a hole in the ice. Natural hole in the ice.
River ice or what?
River ice, right off of a waterfall. Mm-hmm. That's Liberty Falls.
Yeah. Is that around here?
No, that's down near Chitna.
Okay. Mm-hmm. These are lovely.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So what I wanted to focus on with Skookum is this idea that I think that there's this concept of what a traditional Alaskan is, and that we are very much... we reflect our environment so much, and so as we experience the harsh conditions in interior Alaska, in Alaska in general, you know, 20, 30, 40 below, that hardens us. We are a hardened people, and we are a tough and in this case, Skookum group of people. And Skookum is a Chinook jargon word that refers to a whole bunch of things, but particularly refers to strength, resilience, resolve, fortitude. And
is it a native word?
It is based in the Chinook language, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is that Alaskan?
I believe it's Pacific Northwest, but they brought it up here with the gold rush. Yeah. So I wanted to find landscapes that reflected those values. The resilience, the simple beauty, rather than the awe and amazement of Denali. I wanted to really focus on the simplicity, because when it comes to it, Alaskans have to find beauty in the most desolate of places, and we often do. We often have a lot of respect for a place that can very easily kill us, and I wanted to photograph that. I wanted to really, really focus on that somber nature of a wintry landscape.
And maybe the courageous aspect, too.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so it's funny, after years of chasing the sun and trying to get good lighting, and telling my students for years, always shoot during golden hour, always get that good morning or evening light, always seek out those spectacularly well-lit days with long shadows. I'm doing the exact opposite on this project. I'm looking and desperately looking for terrible lighting in the middle of winter. And usually I haven't had a problem, but gosh, the last 2 years I've been fighting to get out on the weekends and still have terrible weather. I've been actually crossing my fingers for terrible weather because it's that muted color color gamut that I really, really enjoy. Yeah.
Okay. Now we're probably getting a little close to the end of our time. And before we're actually at the end, I wanted to ask you, among the things we've talked about or not talked about, anything that you particularly want to talk about, express, or add to our discussion?
So one thing that I've really, really focused on through my development, and I think that it comes from being an educator, but also continuing to educate myself as I'm educating others. Going out for my MFA was one of the best decisions I ever made in my life. It opened my eyes, and it made me vividly aware of how big the world is, and how diverse art can be. And on top of it, it really made me respect education in general, and continuing education especially. And granted, this is an instructor talking about how important education is. And yes, we've all heard that before. But I apply that to myself as well. I love continuing to learn. Case in point, this last, about 2 years ago, I ended up going to a workshop where I learned the chemogram process. A year ago, I ended up going to a workshop on wet plate collodion. This spring, I decided to register for a scanning electron microscope class at UAF, which is completely out of my field. It's something that I normally wouldn't be interested in at all, except for the fact that you're basically controlling a $500,000 camera, and you're taking pictures that you can't without a scanning electron microscope. And so it opened up worlds to me that I had never thought would be subject matter. I spent the entire semester photographing spices, which is something that I'd never be interested in. I keep on pushing myself to go, to find critique and to really listen to people, not just my peers, but also asking former students what they think of my work. Because honestly, they're going to be a lot more critical than you think. And that growth really ends up helping. I think that specifically with Alaskan artists, it is very easy to grow myopic. You're in such a small town. You're isolated so much from the rest of the world that it's very easy to become, quote-unquote, the photographer or the painter without ever bettering yourself, without ever challenging yourself. And that's one thing that I think continuing education really ends up doing. Whether it's a weekend workshop in Seattle or a distance learning class or just picking up a book and trying to challenge yourself, broadening those horizons really end up broadening your work. My work, I would have never thought of working in abstract form with the chemograms if it wasn't for my experience at Academy of Art. I swore to myself that I would never take landscape shots. And yet that's the focus of my work right now. Yeah. And it's because I've changed my perspective and broadened that horizon. And I think that if you ever feel in a rut, the best thing that an artist can do, best thing that a person in general can do, is change something up. Realize that you don't know everything. And challenge the fact that you don't know something. Learn something new and move forward. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I don't have any more questions to ask you. I've really enjoyed listening to you talk about your work and your values, which seem very powerful in this.
Thank you.
And I want to thank you for agreeing to be interviewed. And good luck with your show.
Thank you.